Welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes each month of news, scandal and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The Taxcast is available to everyone on www.tackletaxhavens.com. It's also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, to the Tax Justice Network's YouTube channel, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, look for us on iTunes, or find us on a radio station near you. Coming up later on the Taxcast, what really happened at the Google shareholder meeting vote on a proposal for ethical tax principles? But first, here's a quick Tax Justice news roundup for this month. The OECD's published its latest bright ideas for automatic exchange of information, supposed to reform the broken global tax system. If you're a tax haven, you can opt only to send information, but not receive it. And if you're a developing country, you won't get information unless your systems are set up to reciprocate. Since illicit money flows overwhelmingly out of poorer nations into tax havens, that seems fairly useless. Doesn't look good, does it, for an organisation whose members are some of the world's leading offshore centres? Macedonia's planning to set itself up as a tax haven, and it's now on the Tax Justice Network's watch list. They should go and talk to Cyprus and ask how that worked out for them. World-famous children's author Alan Ohlberg has rejected a Lifetime Achievement Award because it was sponsored by tax-abusing Amazon. He said he didn't want to give them any support or respectability. Some people get it, others don't. In the UK this month, we've seen yet more evidence of companies happy to take taxpayer help, yet contribute nothing to the public purse. It turns out British taxpayers have provided insurance for a deal involving an Irish aircraft leasing company owned by a London private equity firm, which is in turn controlled by a Cayman Islands domiciled firm. Keep up. The government body UK Export Finance is supposed to benefit the economy by helping exporters of UK goods and services win business by providing guarantees, insurance and reinsurance against loss for UK business exports. Daniel Beasley co-wrote the story for The Independent newspaper.
Now, this suggests that UK public money is used to subsidise tax avoidance, and this can be seen consistently in many transactions which UK Export Finance supports. More worryingly, a UK government minister, William Hague, was paid vast sums of money to sit on the political council of a company which is ultimately controlled from a residence in the Cayman Islands, which is also home to 18,000 other companies. Now, although David Cameron takes a tough public line against tax avoidance by these types of companies, we can see that his own governmental department is actually subsidising these practices.
Another day, another leaked offshore client list, this time in Jersey, number 7 on the Financial Secrecy Index. Celebrities, industrial tycoons, UK politicians, a number of donors to the Conservative Party in the UK government, and musicians, the Arctic Monkeys. So far, Jersey's been unusually silent on the subject. The Bulgarian Parliament has changed the law on offshore entities, so companies with opaque ownership will now be barred from bidding for government contracts. They already have a ban on offshore entities taking part in privatisation or property deals. Quite right, too. And finally, country-by-country reporting for European banks is supposed to be introduced from 2015. It means more transparency on their turnover, staff numbers, taxes paid and subsidies received in each country they operate. Now guess who the European Commission's appointed to do a study on the impacts? Accountancy firm PricewaterhouseCoopers. They've not only lobbied against this legislation, they also work as auditors for the big European banks it will affect. Nice work. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John. Jean-Claude Juncker, former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, has now been appointed as the European Union Commission President. Pretty bad news. What could this conflict of interest mean for a man like that who's pretty much dedicated his career to the opposite of tackling transparency?
Well, Jean-Claude Juncker needs to be looked at in the round. And if you look at his career, this is the man who was the architect of tax haven Luxembourg, has been driving that, protecting them from the European Union for many, many years, blocking reform of automatic information exchange processes, clearly has a complete contempt for transparency in the financial world. One of the architects of the ill-conceived Euro project. There's nothing bad in having a single currency, but the way it was designed and implemented was catastrophically bad. You might say he's one of those typical politicians who've been around Brussels for many years. He's a mover, a shaker. He represents those kind of ducking and diving corporate interests that are manipulating the system in favour of their own interests. But the real problem we have here is that if, or rather when, he's elected president of the Commission, and that's going to happen, he will be the man responsible for leading an investigation into the so-called sweetheart deals that Luxembourg, his country, have allegedly struck with PricewaterhouseCoopers and their major corporate clients. And we have to ask the question, is Jean-Claude Juncker likely to act objectively, ensure this investigation is carried forward, even if this embarrasses Luxembourg and other tax haven countries within Europe? Or is he likely to do the same old thing that he's been known for donkey's years, protect Luxembourgian interests, protect the financial services industry, act on behalf of the financial services and their clients? The real worry here is that appointing Jean-Claude Juncker will only fuel the really strong feelings amongst the European public that politicians in Brussels remain remote, remain captive to corporate special interests. They're not particularly interested in democracy. They've shown very little concern about the rise of extreme parties, particularly extreme parties on the right in many countries in Europe. And his appointment, I think, underscores the public disenchantment with the European Union project and a general drift towards a corporate-dominated superstate. In other words, a European Union, which is gradually taking on all the appearance of being run by corporates, for corporates. There's a name for this. It's called fascism.
Right, and that's a pretty worrying state of affairs, as you say, for democracy. And speaking of that, we move on to Hong Kong, which, of course, is ranked number 3 in the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. And we've had all sorts of things going on there with the big 4 accountancy firms getting quite worried about the pro-democracy movement there, and they've just clubbed together to publish a kind of advertisement or statement denouncing Occupy Central, as they call themselves, which is also another nasty demonstration of all that's wrong with these huge accounting firms and the influences that they have on places that are trying to become democratic, just as we seem to be losing that in Europe.
Well, that's right. This is the most extraordinary story. We in Europe and in North America, in other words, the old West, have been pointing fingers at China for many, many years and saying, you are totalitarian, you're autocratic, blah, 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 you should be moving towards democracy. Now, the Chinese have said that they will allow the people of Hong Kong the opportunity to elect their own leaders. In other words, a step in the direction of democracy. Hong Kong has a very vibrant dissident grouping on the streets a lot, in the newspapers a lot, pushing for democratization. And what happens? Well, the big 4 accountancy firms, that is KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young, Deloitte & Touche, get together and they put an advertisement into the Hong Kong newspapers. You actually can't believe that this is true. And in this advertisement, they call upon the general public to oppose the referendum, to oppose democracy, because they think that all the vibrancy and the dissent of democracy will actually persuade multinational companies, their clients, to leave Hong Kong. This is truly extraordinary. But this isn't the first time that big accountancy firms and the finance sector have been very involved in opposing democracy. And in fact, if you go back to the 1930s, you'll find that many of them were quite actively involved with Nazi Germany and the Nazi German government. Many of them were involved in apartheid South Africa, accounting firms and some of the world's biggest banks. In fact, for years and years, Barclays Bank suffered a boycott as a result of its appeasement and working with the apartheid South African government. So there's a track record within the financial services industry. They are not interested in democracy. They see democracy as a threat because the last thing they want is genuine democracy, which might actually lead to, for example, a financial transaction tax or better taxation of capital.
Right, so very worrying situation there. And looking at what some countries have actually been doing at the moment, on the one hand, we've got the OECD moving on rather slowly with their supposed tax justice reforms. And we've got many countries who simply are being closed out of that situation while the wealthy rich club members of the OECD seem to decide these things amongst themselves, of course, to their own advantage. So what we're seeing recently is lots of examples of developing countries taking matters into their own hands and realising that there's no point kind of waiting around. So we've seen in Kenya, for example, a lot more companies shifting parts of their operations offshore to avoid tax. And so we've got the Kenyan Revenue Authority addressing abusive transfer pricing by building up their own database of prices so they can compare them to the prices companies are charging themselves when they transfer goods from one part of the business to the other. And they're expecting to raise an extra $565 million from that. And Uganda, we've just had a court ruling there that a tax incentive granted to a UK-listed company, Tullow Oil, was illegal and actually cheated Ugandans out of at least $407 million, which they're going to have to pay back. So some interesting things going on there with countries doing it for themselves.
Yes, we are living in very exciting times because the old order is clearly in retreat. And by the old order, I mean the Western-dominated institutions like the OECD, the IMF and the World Bank. If we look elsewhere, for example, in the last few weeks, we've seen not just events in Uganda and Kenya, where governments are saying the old ways of working with multinational companies have led to a lot of cheating. We've seen, for example, the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, now coming forward with creating a new development bank which will compete with the Washington-based World Bank. This is a crucial step towards reversing the control imposed by the United States and its allies through the World Bank over lending practices and conditions imposed upon developing countries. So that's another indication that the old order is gradually beginning to lose its control. And this has got to be a good thing.
Are the BRICS going to do any better?
It's very unlikely the BRICS will do any better. Time will tell to see how this new development bank emerges. But the gradual loss of control by the US and United Kingdom and all of the allies will diminish their power and diminish their opportunity to abuse the system, which they have been doing so clearly for such a long time. And the threat of losing further power might well actually force them to take some genuine steps to reform in the right direction. That's the only hope that one can hold out at the moment. But I think the news coming out of the Kenyan Revenue Authority, that they're now taking clear steps to, first of all, collect data on prices to use as comparables to resist abusive transfer pricing and profit shifting. And they're also taking steps to amend the definition they use in their law, permanent establishment, to restrict transactions between related parties. All of these steps, which they're taking unilaterally, show that they're finally starting to take control over their own destiny. And that's got to be good news.
And on that subject, there's been a great piece on the Tax Justice Network website this month, written by one of our senior advisors, Krishan Mehta, which is 10 pointers on how developing countries can take control over their tax destinies. Among these points, he talks about safe harbours, the dictum and fiscal rule like they have in Mexico, talking about reviewing and renegotiating natural resource contracts. So really great stuff being put out there.
Yes, the important thing here is that Krishan's identified 10 key steps that developing countries can take by themselves, unilaterally, without having to refer to any international institution. And these steps will help them to strengthen their own ability to tax. And the steps include, for example, applying safe harbour arrangements in order to limit the way in which multinational companies use excessive management fees and service charges and interest expenses to shift profits to tax havens. He says that in the majority of cases, developing countries should resist pressure to sign up to international tax treaties because these tax treaties don't demonstrably attract additional investment. In most cases, they're completely unnecessary. They actually impose conditions upon developing countries which are not in their interests. So he's saying, resist that, be cautious about signing any tax treaties. In combination, these 10 proposals, all of which are up on our blog, will help developing countries to capture a much larger share of the taxable profits that they should be able to tax, and will strengthen their tax regimes enormously. And I think this is something to be very excited about. We're now seeing some countries take measures to fight back against corporate tax avoidance, to fight back against corporate tax evasion, and to fight back against Western institutions which have clearly failed to put into place the right regime for a globalised financial order.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Time now for the TaxCast special feature. Google's catchphrase is, don't be evil. But Google CEO Eric Schmidt says he's proud of his company's outrageously low taxes, thanks in part to Bermuda and Ireland. We've got governments dragging their heels when it comes to legislation to force multinational companies to make a fair contribution to the societies that make their businesses possible. But now, are shareholders beginning to wake up to the risks? This month, the TaxCast looks at Google's recent annual shareholders meeting.
Well, it's another great day here in Mountain View, California. And it's great to have you here on a pretty steamy California afternoon. Let me begin by the most important question of the morning. How was the food? Okay. If you missed the food, you missed at least half the value of the shareholder meeting, in my opinion, but what do I know? Okay. Good.
That's Google's CEO, Eric Schmidt. CEOs like him love to tell you it's a fiduciary duty to shareholders to minimise his company's tax bill. But that's not actually true. UK law firm Farrah & Co. found that to be, quote, wholly misconceived and, quote, unknown to English law, close quote. The Tax Justice Network's pretty sure a legal analysis in the US would come to the same conclusion. And it may be that shareholders are starting to think more about how tax avoidance could affect their investment portfolios. Let's get back now to this year's Google stockholders meeting and an interesting proposal on tax.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board and fellow shareholders. My name is Michelle de Cordova of NEI Investments of Toronto. I'm here representing Domini Social Investments to move proposal number 7, addressing Google's tax strategies. So our proposal asks Google to establish ethical principles guiding its approach to tax. It may seem an unusual request from shareholders. You might assume that investors will be pleased to see the company pay as little tax as possible. But the sponsors of this proposal are fiduciaries. We see tax avoidance as a short-sighted strategy that threatens the foundations of society and of long-term wealth creation. And we think it threatens Google as well. Now, to be very clear, this is not a vote on tax reform or how much tax Google should pay. We just believe Google would benefit from a set of ethical principles to help it navigate the complexity of tax regimes around the world. Google is a very unusual company, founded on a principle to do no harm, don't be evil. We know Google works hard to live by this principle. Right now, Google's tax strategies exploit differences between national regimes, shifting profits from higher tax jurisdictions to low or no tax jurisdictions. Now, these tactics may not be illegal, but utilizing one jurisdiction to eliminate or minimize tax payments in another can and has invited potentially costly responses from the disadvantaged governments. We think Google should consider the impact of its tax strategies on society to anticipate changes to tax regulations, ensure continued consumer loyalty, and protect the value of the brand. Tax is really an investment in society, so what is our return on that investment? We think corporations and investors depend upon tax revenues to fund indispensable government services that can't be financed by corporate philanthropy or by a rise in the share price. Google itself might not exist if it had not been for taxpayer-funded research, financed by a taxpayer-funded National Science Foundation grant. We just feel you can't have it both ways. We think tax avoidance threatens future innovation and growth and more. Ultimately, corporate tax avoidance is a threat to government and to the rule of law, and no investor or company can really succeed for very long without a functioning government and legal system. As fiduciaries and long-term investors, we need resilient economies and societies that can stand up to the inevitable shocks that the future will bring. So we think Google's board should ask itself, what is the end game here? How long can our companies and our economies survive if corporations continue a race to the bottom on tax? So today, your shareholders are asking you to set a higher standard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cordova.
It's fair to say not everybody at this meeting appreciated this proposal. Here's the reaction from one stockholder who appealed to the board.
The proposal to pay more taxes is outrageous. Why did you let that go through? What a stupid idea. Why doesn't Google fight at the SEC to throw these crappy proposals out?
So, what was the result of the shareholder vote? Here's one of the people involved in making that proposal, the Managing Director of Domini Social Investments, Adam Kanzer.
Well, this is possibly the lowest vote I've ever received on a shareholder proposal. First off, it's important to understand the structure of the voting at Google. So the three top executives hold an additional class of shares that grants them 10 votes for every share. So normal shareholders get one vote per share. They get 10 votes per share. So they control more than 60% of the vote. And in some cases, depending on how many shareholders actually vote, it could be upwards of 70% of the vote. So I didn't expect to get a very high vote. And I know this is a new issue for a lot of investors. And I think also, a lot of investors have this knee-jerk reaction when you raise the question of corporate tax. The assumption is that tax minimization is in shareholders' best interests. And why would I encourage a company to pay more in tax? That being said, the vote was even lower than I expected. So we got a 1% vote. If you take out the management control shares, it only rises to 4%. Still extremely low, but a very high percentage of abstention. So close to 20% of shareholders abstained, which to me means that there's a lot of large institutional investors out there that are on the fence about this issue, that don't have a policy, and did not want to go so far as to vote with management or to vote against. They really couldn't quite work it out yet. So I'm not that surprised that the vote was very low, and I'm heartened by the fact that there were so many investors that chose to abstain.
Right, and it's easy to forget, isn't it, that companies and shareholders haven't always behaved this way on tax. I mean, there was quite a cultural shift in this area starting from around the 1980s. But the number of abstentions is interesting, isn't it? And it could be, couldn't it, the beginning of another shift in thinking.
The capital markets depend on legal structures. They depend on governments. That's ignored frequently. It's thought of as a purely private activity, but it's not. It's a highly regulated activity. And it's a highly regulated activity that is supposed to serve societal interests. The societal interests have, for many investors, been sort of written out of the equation. And in fact, a lot of investors will tell you that they're not even legally able to think about societal interests, which is just not true. And they will tell you, well, fiduciary duty, I'm not allowed to think about that. I need to think about stock price. I need to think about making money for my client. But the truth of the matter is that they need to think about long-term risk-adjusted returns. And if once you say risk-adjusted, that brings in all sorts of other issues. If you're a public pension fund that's partially underfunded because your state is on the verge of bankruptcy, and part of that is because the tax base has been depleted by companies that are engaging in aggressive tax minimization strategies, then it's your fiduciary duty to do something about that. And at the very least, to reach out to those companies and talk to them about it, and to get the CFO on the phone and say, what are you doing?
Right. And if shareholders care about nothing else, there's something they really should care about that's quite fundamental. I suppose it's what Donald Rumsfeld might have called the known unknowns, or maybe even the unknown unknowns.
There's a whole transparency question here. Even if you're just a classic investor that's only interested in making as much money as possible and only interested in pure shareholder value, can you really say that you truly understand the finances of a company like Google or Microsoft, for that matter, or Apple, or any of the large multinationals, you know, using these aggressive tax strategies? Can you really say that you fully understand it? Because these strategies are not discussed in their securities filings. They're noted, they're sort of mentioned. If you read through Google's 10K, they note in a number of places that, you know, we benefit from use of lower tax regions. They don't explain how it's structured. And, you know, another piece here is that about a year ago, a number of these companies, including Google, have dramatically reduced their disclosure of their subsidiaries. They went down from over 100 subsidiaries to, I think, 3, 2 in Ireland and 1 in Delaware. Well, they have at least one important subsidiary in Bermuda, which they apparently use as, you know, the linchpin of their tax strategy, but they've deemed it to be not significant, and so they don't need to disclose it. How much is being swept under the rug, and how much of that is information that investors actually need to know to understand how the company works? If you don't have all that information, one, you can't evaluate the risks because you don't know how risky those strategies are, and two, can you really understand how much of the company's future value is based on superior products and services, and how much of the company's value is based on creative accounting? Now, some investors may be quite happy with creative accounting as long as it's legal, but I think they recognize that that's not as reliable a source of revenues as the superior products and services.
So what now, Adam? What happens to this proposal now?
We can't refile it because the vote was too low. You have to get, in the first year, you have to get at least a 3% vote. Now, what's interesting about that is that if you exclude the management control votes, remember, they get 10 votes per share, we would have had enough to resubmit it. But that is what it is. The goal of filing a proposal, from our perspective, is not simply to get a vote. These are non-binding proposals, so even if we got, you know, an 80% vote, the company could still choose to ignore it. They don't have to do what we're asking them to do. What actually happened here is that Google did agree to talk to us. So they weren't talking to us before, and they're talking to us now. So we've had one conversation and a commitment to continue the conversation. And I'm not sure where that's going right now, but it's an opportunity for us to share our perspectives, and we'll see where that goes. The more we talk to the long-term investors and the broadly diversified investors that really do have a stake in the economy, because a significant portion of portfolio returns just come from economic growth generally, I think they'll get it. There are significant potential liabilities. You know, Google was just handed a tax bill by the French authorities that might be up to $1.4 billion. Now, that's maybe pocket change for Google, but if they end up paying a portion of that, I think a whole bunch of other countries are going to step up to the plate and ask for their share. And then it's going to start to get expensive. So I think things are going to change, and I think the risks are going to become more apparent to investors.
You've been listening to the TaxCast. We'll be back next month.